In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Thank you for joining me today on the iSpy Radio Show. If this is your first time tuning in, a special welcome to you. Or if it's been a while, let me explain a little bit about the show. We are a one-hour conservative talk show dedicated to keeping an eye on big government. We've had people describe us as a weekly seminar for all things conservative, and that about sums it up. Every week we have only one or two guests for the full hour, so that way we can get down really deep into their topic. Most news or talk shows focus a lot of attention on the who, the what, and the where, but very little time on the how or why. We take the opposite approach. We focus on the how and the why. There's no yelling here. We don't shout over our guests. We don't have multiple guests on at the same time who all spend their time shouting over one another. Nobody learns anything that way. And that's our goal. Our goal is that you come away with a deeper understanding about the topic. Because informed people make better decisions. Informed people aren't so easily swayed by the less informed. And there is a lot of bad information out there. We started in Salem with a focus on the legislature. We're now a network of stations across Oregon. And we focus on bigger national level issues, but still focused on Oregon. Because as we've said before, Oregon is very often the petri dish for all things from the left, experimenting with policies here and how to roll them out in other states. On today's show, we have a very big issue for you. We're talking foreign policy and international strategy. Now, there are three ways countries engage each other strategically: diplomatically, militarily, and economically. Today, we're focusing on the last two, military and economy. So imagine a gigantic jigsaw puzzle, and you're trying to fit your little piece on there. But when you finally figure out where it fits within the within that bigger puzzle, suddenly all of the other pieces of the puzzle change. And that is essentially what happens when it comes to international strategy. And that's what you'll definitely hear from our guests today, the changing minefields of international strategy. Now, why does this matter? It's because some of our leaders want war. They want conflict because they want to control. Big government control. And what you'll also hear on today's show is why big government is never the answer, not in the U.S. and certainly not a new world order. Listen in so you won't be fooled. I'd like to welcome now Krista Huff. She is a stock market expert and a political activist. She is the chief analyst at Cabot Undervalued Stocks Advisor. In 2016, Krista was instrumental in defeating the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement by convincing Republican congresspeople that the TPP would give up a significant amount of U.S. sovereignty, which it most certainly would. Krista, it was fun to talk to you about that last time, and welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here.
Yeah, you know, the last time we had you on, as I mentioned, this was actually back in the Republican primaries. It seems ages ago now. But we were talking a lot about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It was a hot topic then. Since then, President Trump has pulled us out of the TPP. But let's talk a little bit about that to examine what it means to the U.S. to be out from under the threat of the TPP. One of the real shocking elements from our discussion last time was the notion that it was really going to destroy our sovereignty. Explain how that would have worked if we had continued with that.
If we had joined the TPP, we would have been subject to decisions made by a global commission very similar to the way when France and Belgium and such joined the European Union. They were no longer sovereign nations. They had to do what the European Union Commission told them to do. And it would have been exactly the same with the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. So Congress would not be able to, dictate to America what will take place here. The Global Commission would have outranked Congress.
What gets me is that anybody looked at that and thought, oh, that's a good idea.
The thing is, people didn't look at it. The document was secret for a very, very long time. until they passed fast-track trade promotion authority, which was like greasing the skids for the trade agreement itself. And only then did the trade agreement become available to the public and to Congress people, by the way, because it was hidden from most of them as well.
Yes.
But the document was over 5,000 pages long, and you know, all of the pro-TPP people were visiting Congress and telling them all kinds of things that had nothing to do with the sovereignty giveaway. So they were making it sound really attractive.
Hmm. You know, it sounds a lot like what happened here in Oregon, where you had these Republicans that were sold on this notion of overhauling our healthcare system and putting through our own version of Obamacare, all under the guise of, oh, it's going to save money. And I think when Republicans hear it's going to save money, suddenly they just lose their common sense.
Right. And I think one of the other problems is life in America is extraordinarily complicated. If you
Yes.
can picture any legislator, whether they're in Congress or they're in your state legislature, they could come from any walk of life. They could be a construction business owner. They could be a pediatrician. And all of a sudden, they need to be an expert on everything. And they need to decide very quickly how they're going to vote on myriad topics every single day. I mean,
yes.
It really is that rushed and everything shoved down their throats, and they're like deers in the headlights. And so when it came to trade, they just said, oh, well, we are Republicans and we like trade, so I'll vote yes. And I had to visit Congress, and I visited over about 100 Republican Congress people and their offices. And I had to explain to them, you know, very nicely, because I was giving them information they didn't want to hear. I had to explain to them why this trade agreement was not a good idea for America, and do it in such a friendly manner that they were willing to consider changing their minds.
Yeah, well, and I think that's really important how you approach them with that trusting manner there, where you're building trust with them rather than screaming and yelling at them, which is unfortunately what too many...
Isn't going to work,
yeah,
right.
No, it just doesn't work. Too many people use that. As far as the TPP is concerned, is it truly dead, or are there people in the Trump administration, like what we're seeing with the Paris Accords, they're trying to revive that? Are they trying to revive the TPP at all?
The TPP itself cannot be revived unless the U.S. says, we change our mind, we want the TPP exactly the way it was.
Hmm.
So we withdrew from the trade agreement, and the trade agreement cannot move forward without U.S. participation. So it is completely dead at this point. Now, if folks around the world want to come up with a new trade agreement that's somewhat different and more palatable, they are certainly free to work on that. And I don't, you know, I'm sure there are people all over the world working on such things right now. But in terms of the TPP, it's not going to come back in a month. No.
Yeah, well, just like government, just because it was a bad idea the first time around doesn't mean that you won't try it again. So,
Obamacare, right?
That's right, yeah. All right, let's take a break there. Coming up, U.S. oil exports are surging. What is going on with that and why? And welcome back. We're talking international strategic issues today on the iSpy Radio Show, specifically trade and military. Right now we're talking about trade with Krista Huff. She's the chief analyst at Cabot Undervalued Stocks Advisor. Many of her articles are on goodfellowllc.com, or you can subscribe to her newsletter at cabotwealth.com. And then later on we'll be talking Russia with Carl Higbee, so stay tuned for that. You know, a vastly different situation has arisen here in terms of the oil markets. Many people, myself included, are used to thinking of the U.S. as an oil importer, mainly from OPEC. But now our crude oil is being gobbled up by foreign refiners. You have a great article about that. What is causing this dramatic and rapid rise in U.S. crude oil exports?
This is a long story that started back in the early 1970s when OPEC decided that there would be an oil embargo and they would not sell their oil to the U.S. So the U.S. at that point was forced to rely on its own energy production. But the problem came in when Gerald Ford, the president at the time, signed the Energy Policy and Conservation Act of 1975, which made it illegal for U.S. companies to export crude oil without a license to all countries except Canada. So we shut down our export business at that point. And it stayed that way for about 40 years. And then on top of that, various administrations, especially the Obama administration, made it more and more difficult for the U.S. to produce any energy at all. So we weren't selling it to ourselves and we weren't selling it to foreigners. And finally, in December of 2015, Congress changed their mind and authorized the export of U.S. crude oil without a license. And since that time, the amount that we export per day has gone from less than 100,000 barrels per day to over 1 million barrels per day.
Yeah, it just absolutely skyrocketed there. I'm a little surprised that President Obama signed that bill into law. I mean, that December 15, he was still in power at that point.
I don't know the politics behind why he ever would have agreed to that. Maybe Congress so overwhelmingly wanted it that he was pushed up against a barrel.
Hmm. Or maybe George Soros or Warren Buffett happened to own a lot of oil reserves. So hard to say. But, I mean, it was interesting to see the impact of that bill there in 1975, that Energy Policy and Conservation Act of 1975. It's just, again, big government work here where they were making it so it was supposedly the reason for passing that in the first place was to protect the oil reserves. Well, that doesn't seem to that didn't seem to work at all.
No, if you want to conserve your oil reserves, which was one of Congress's goals, then you use less of them, not more of them.
Yeah.
But by making us energy independent and unable to access foreign oil, we were forced to use more of our oil reserves. Now, I'm not saying that it's bad to use our oil reserves. I'm just saying that they made a law that accomplished exactly opposite of what they intended.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A law that limits oil exports isn't going to stop oil imports. And again, it screwed up the underlying market there where you don't have the ability to sell and you're forced to import. I mean, none of that made sense. And we have certainly seen that with the skyrocketing oil prices over those years. And it's interesting to wonder what they would have been had we not had that market interference.
Without government interference. I mean, is there any market that you can name that benefits from the government having their hand in it? I certainly can't name one, but I'm a very small government proponent. As far as I'm concerned, if we just had police to protect us from criminals and protect us at times of war, that's all I need the government for.
Yeah, well, and it's not even just the government. I mean, look at the failure of experts, and you mentioned this in that article there, where you had these analysts predicting almost the exact opposite of what actually happened. They were predicting no motivation for foreign markets to buy U.S. oil. The cost of shipping would be prohibitive and more. And instead, they just absolutely, as you mentioned earlier, they skyrocketed.
Right. And the analyst that I quoted in the article even said, well, even if we sell some of our oil overseas, nobody from Asia is going to want to buy it.
Yes.
Well, it turns out from early 2016 to early 2017, the percentage of U.S. crude oil exports that go to Asia have increased from 5% of the total to 26% of the total, with China, Japan, and Thailand being the major destinations.
Yes.
So it looks like not only did we not necessarily want to buy our oil from the Middle East because, you know, many of those countries sort of hate us, right? There are political problems. There are religious problems. And so it's not pleasant doing business with those countries. Well, apparently a lot of other countries around the world might have the same point of view since they're all rushing to buy the U.S. crude now.
Yeah. And is there a huge difference in price between U.S. oil and Saudi oil?
Well, I know right now, for instance, today there's a $2.60 price per barrel between West Texas Intermediate and Brent.
And Brent
generally
is...
Yeah,
I was going to say, go ahead and define for our audience what Brent is.
It's just the oil that's more available on the foreign markets.
And so our oil is more expensive?
Our oil is a little less expensive
A little less expensive. Okay. Well, that could certainly explain some of why they're gobbling it up, but not entirely, especially when you account shipping and whatnot. Okay. Oil, of course, is going to have huge importance there, not just in the world markets, but as you mentioned, in the geopolitics of the Middle East. And coming up, we're going to be talking about some of that. Especially with Russia and also Syria. Stay with us.
Get a little intelligence on big government. You're listening to the iSpy Radio Show.
And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking international strategic issues today. I'm talking with Krista Huff. She is the chief analyst at Cabot Undervalued Stocks. And many of her articles can be found on goodfellowllc.com or cabotwealth.com as well. Now, you're on Twitter, right? At Krista Huff. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
At Krista Huff. So you can find her there too. And of course, we'll link all of that up on iSpyRadio.com. Just look for today's show page, which is 716. And I'd like to talk a little bit about Russia because that's going to be the focus of our next segment as well with Carl Higbee. And, you know, Russia's economy is hugely dependent on oil. And the U.S. is a relatively new entrant to that market, has to be worrisome to them. What do you think their reaction is going to be to the U.S. Starting to squeeze in on their territory, so to speak?
I know that right now Russia is forming stronger relationships with both China and Vietnam. Each of these countries wants to accomplish things that maybe keep the U.S. somewhat at bay. And so they are aligning with energy, they're aligning with trade, they're aligning with military. Russia is apparently providing Vietnam with a lot of military equipment and such. So while I know that U.S. energy companies potentially do a lot of business in Russia, I think everyone's keeping all of their relationships as strong as they can so that no particular player dominates. And right now, you know, they don't want to let the U.S. dominate in the global theater.
So in terms of how they compete on the world market, I mean, if we look at them as, you know, the Russian corporation versus the U.S. corporation, when you've got competitors there, you're going to look for various competitive advantages. Whether you're able to do something less expensively than your competitors are. It sounds like from what you're describing there, Russia is looking at using a lot of add-ons where they're waving the oil in front of them. But also, if you buy that, then you can also get some military equipment for you know, X percentage off. I mean, is that essentially their approach?
Yeah. Also, the U.S. has been forming alliances in the countries that are surrounding China. And China doesn't necessarily want that to happen, and Russia doesn't necessarily want that to happen. So if Russia forms a strong relationship with Vietnam in terms of selling the military equipment and stuff, that prevents the U.S. from having that strong identical relationship with Vietnam. And that makes China happy because China wants fewer of the countries surrounding it to have strong relationships with the U.S. So while China doesn't like it that Russia is selling military equipment to Vietnam, they like that better than the U.S. selling military equipment to Vietnam.
What a complicated situation.
I know.
It's really mind-boggling sometimes when you look, if you move this little piece here, then that forces these other ones to move. I mean, what a fascinating situation. The U.S., really one of the reasons why we are even a player at this point is because of our increasing use of technology with fracking and whatnot. Is Russia moving in that direction at all, or do they have enough oil reserves they don't need to do that sort of thing?
I don't know where they stand on fracking. I know that that lots of big U.S. and European energy companies are actively engaging with Russia, going into joint ventures and such. So the energy relationship is somewhat wide open globally.
Well, focusing in on the Middle East then, the war in Syria started not too long after Syria, a friend of Russia, declined to let Saudi Arabia build a massive pipeline across Syria to Europe to be able to put their oil into the European markets. And Syria declined in order to protect Russian oil. Saudi Arabia supports many of the rebels and terrorists there in Syria to try to create a regime change to allow that Saudi pipeline. Do you see the oil, the changing oil market now that the U.S. is a bigger player? Is that going to impact things like the Syrian war at all?
It could make, just like many other countries, European countries might start buying more crude oil from the U.S. so that they rely less on the Middle East and they don't have to be as involved in the tensions there. So that might upset Syria. That might upset the entire global apple cart. But right now, everything's shifting in terms of where people are buying their crude oil. And the U.S. currently selling over a million barrels a day. That didn't level out 5 months ago. That was going up month after month after month even through March, hitting new numbers. So a few weeks from now, when we see the April numbers, they'll probably be higher again. So what we have is for stock market investors, not oil so much, but stocks, they should take a look at U.S. integrated oil companies, because right now those oil companies have a whole big market that has just started opening up to them. And at this point, the sky's the limit. It's like looking at, a small cap aggressive growth stock in terms of that portion of their business. So U.S. integrated oil stocks are not business as usual this year or next year, and people should be prepared for surprises in profitability.
Surprises to the good or to the bad?
I would say to the good. These companies are making tons of money right now, but also remember that they're coming off of some bad years. And so many industries are cyclical. Certainly the oil industry is cyclical, especially since we had the crash in oil prices a while back. They are all zooming rapidly per year now with increases in profitability. So I don't expect them to become boring blue chip stocks again for another several years.
Hmm. Any particular that you recommend? Or should people get your newsletter?
They are welcome to. In my newsletter, I have three integrated oil companies. Two of them are foreign and one of them is from the U.S. So I won't mention those names because those are for subscribers. But I will add one more name that I did not recommend to my subscribers, and that is Chevron. It is equally as attractive as the other three in my newsletter. Their profits are growing hand over fist both this year and next year. Big dividend, very low debt levels, everything that I want to see in a stock. There's not only no compromise when I'm picking Chevron, but any company that had the numbers that I see with Chevron, I would gleefully purchase and expect to make money in.
Well, how cool. And people can get that newsletter through capitalwealth.com, correct?
Exactly.
All right. Well, great. Chris, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be here.
And coming up next, Carl Higbee. You've seen him on Fox News. We'll be talking about Russia and those quagmires, North Korea and Syria. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking now to Carl Higbee. He was a special operator with SEAL Team 10 Echo Platoon, and he's also a regular contributor on Fox News. He has a book out there, Enemies, Foreign and Domestic, A SEAL Story. I've had the pleasure of reading that, and I would highly recommend that. And plus, our good friend Scott McEwen wrote the foreword to that. And so, Carl, it's good to talk to you again.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. You know, let's start with a smoldering hot topic, Syria. I mean, this is the war that won't go away, it seems. And back in 2015, Obama had come out saying, oh, well, let's work with Russia and Iran, and we're going to try to end this civil war. And at the time, they were saying, by then, 200,000 people had been killed. Millions more had been displaced into neighboring countries and the European countries, of course. Since then, there have been multiple terrorist attacks on citizens in European countries and the U.S. What are your thoughts about Obama's strategy back during that time, especially by the fact that he didn't back any of it up with a military presence?
Well, I mean, Obama's had the most limp-wristed foreign policy I've ever seen in my lifetime, which has been a few presidents. But I think, he has absolutely bent us back into a corner because he didn't back up any of his actions. And now, when anytime President Trump decides that he needs to give any type of force on any level, it seemed as so shocking because we've been so long with so little.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's kind of how the media is portraying it, too, is that Trump doesn't really have a strategy. He's just out there bombing and making threats. And people used to say that about Obama. Well, the people on the right side of the article, I used to say that about Obama not having a strategy. But the problem was he would then announce that strategy. And I think people, like you say, it's a total reversal of what we've had for the last 8 years.
Oh, completely. I mean, even President Trump said it from the Rose Garden on Easter. He says, I'm not going to broadcast my strategy, which is absolutely right. He doesn't put leaflets in before he bombs something. He doesn't go tell people. The only thing he did, he extended the olive branch to the Russians when he bombed Assad's airfield with the Tomahawk missiles, because he didn't want to start a war. So he said, you know what, you guys, my beef is not with you, so go ahead and get on out of here, and we're just going to destroy the airfield and the chemical weapons depots. It's the only time he's ever communicated his strategy.
Well, and I think you're right in the sense that he was trying to extend the olive branch at that point. But all of this does come down to strategy, but you can't have a strategy without a goal. If Obama's goal was to weaken the U.S. and the Middle East, then I would say he pulled it off spectacularly.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happened. The Middle East was completely destroyed by the lack of American intervention. That's what it comes down to.
Yes. Well, and by sending the Tomahawks the way that he did, in your opinion, did that change hearts and minds there in the Middle East in terms of their perception of the U.S. And our role there in the Middle East?
Here's the truth, Bob. The Middle East as a whole, like, I mean, I'm sure there's people that love the West and things like that, but the Middle East, on a majority, does not like the Western societies. They just don't.
Yeah.
And anybody who says otherwise is A, never been there, B, has their head in the sand. So, you know, you're not going to change these hearts and minds. I mean, we went into Iraq and we toppled a dictator that, ironically, we put in place in the first place, which was Saddam. Then we went in there and decided that we were going to nation build, but we didn't have a goal. We didn't have an understanding of the culture or anything like that. Now we're about to do it again in Syria. And, I've written a few pieces, one of which is in The Hill, which talks about how complicated the Syria situation is. Like, you have two options. You can leave Assad there, or you can take him out. Those are the first two options. Now, if we leave him there, we have to be willing to live with his murderous dictatorship. If we take him out, we have to be willing to live with the fact that we might have to be there for five decades to reintegrate a culture into a completely different style of governing. If we do half of either, it's worthless.
Mm. Well, let's say that Carl Higbee is in charge of U.S. foreign interests there in the Middle East. Which of those two options would you opt for?
I would leave Assad there. I would say I would get on first. The first things first is I would get on the same page as the Russians. I would say, all right, Putin, we got to sit down and talk about this because we can't fight a 1980s proxy war like we did during the Cold War. It just doesn't work. So you want Assad there? Why? Okay, you want an airbase? Fine. Here's our line. We're going to say you can do whatever you want. You can have your airbase. That's fine with us. But here's our line. If Assad uses chemical weapons, then we will bomb him. We will bomb and destroy the entire installation that those chemical weapons can be conclusively traced to. Period. No question. No, the people's argument is, well, what they're saying now is a rogue general might have done. Even worse, that means Assad does not have control over his own weaponry, if that's actually the case. So that's even worse, and it needs to be addressed. I would say, if Putin says, well, if you bomb in Russia, we run the risk of going to war, I would call his bluff. Because Putin does not have the resources, he does not have the money, nor does he have the desire to go to war with the United States of America.
Yeah.
And we're not going to war with him. That's the bottom line. And people now have let this thing go so far out of proportion. Guess what? We can't afford to be, physically, fiscally, anything. We cannot afford to be the world's police as we have been trying to do, but we've been doing it, half-charged. It just doesn't work.
No. Well, and like any strategy, you can't do it half-hearted. You've got to go all in on that strategy. And like you said, us having the strategy of being the world's policeman just absolutely has not worked. And in terms of the chemical attack, we only got about a minute here with you. In terms of the chemical attack, what do you think is the truth there? I'm of the opinion it was more likely ISIS than it was the Syrian forces because, to me, there's no strategic sense for him to suddenly launch a whole bunch of chemical weapons when he'd been basically winning for the last 6 months.
Well, we can trace the flight pattern from the drop of the chemical weapons back to one of Assad's bases. So, I mean, my belief is that it was Assad. Of course he's going to deny it because he doesn't want responsibility for it. But in denying it, like I said, he makes himself seem like he has even less control over his whole country, which is a serious problem.
Yeah, well, it is a quagmire for sure. All right, everyone stay with us. We'll have lots more with Carl Higbee coming up after this. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking about international strategic issues today, specifically issues of trade and economics, and now we're talking military. In the first half of our show, we talked with Krista Huff. She is a stock market expert with Cabot Wealth Management. Just head to cabotwealth.com if you'd like to read some of her articles. And right now we're talking with Carl Higbee, who was a special operator with SEAL Team 10. You probably recognize him, though, from Fox News. which is kind of having its own issues right now, but we'll leave that aside. But anyway, Carl, it's really the more you tear apart Syria, it's the more complicated of a puzzle it seems to get. And before we leave it completely off the table, in terms of that chemical weapons attack, some of the theories that I've seen floated on that is, yes, they did track the airplane that launched that weapon, but is it possible that that was just a regular old bomb and it hit a chemical munitions supply?
Generally unlikely, but and just for the listeners, going back into Syria, Syria is far more complicated than most people understand. The issue is it's not a good versus bad, black versus white. It's not like that in Syria. Sure. You have over half a dozen moving parts. You have Assad, you have the rebels, you have the Kurds, you have ISIS, you have Turkey, you have the United States, you have Iran, you have Russia, and now Jordan, allegedly. So you have all, and any number of aid groups like USAID or the UN or anything like that. So there, everyone's in there. And the problem is nobody's on the same page. We're not on the same page as Russia. Russia and Iran are generally on the same page. The Shiite Muslim population is not happy with ISIS, not happy with the Kurds. So you have, came from the rebels that we armed, we gave munitions to. Then a small faction of the rebel forces against Assad broke off and began actually fighting other rebels to take more of the munitions that we were giving to them as the United States of America. Mm-hmm. So the dynamic there is completely backwards. I mean, and you have to understand it. And in order to understand it, you have to give way to the culture there, which is they have religious and tribal allegiances that are beyond any government allegiances, which, you know, along with they have no geographical allegiances there either. So the problem is much more specific and it is much more difficult than just good versus bad over there.
Yes. Well, and add to that, you've got the issues with the oil. And then we had touched on this with our last guest there, Krista Huff. And the Syrian war started soon after these plans that, you know, Russia wanted, well, it was actually Qatar, wanting to put an oil pipeline through there with Saudi Arabia's help. And Syria rejected that and instead decided to go with an Iranian plan. And you've got both Qatar and Saudi Arabia supporting a lot of those rebels that are in there opposing Assad.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, and it's all backwards, and everybody funds, you know, someone at some point, sooner or later, that's going to be in opposition to them. I mean, look, we've given weapons to countless oppositions. I mean, we armed Al-Qaeda back in the day and gave them Stinger missiles to shoot down Russian helicopters in the 80s. Guess how that's working out for us now? Not so great. So, I mean, you have the dynamic here. Look, everybody can agree. I think that everybody minus Russia can agree that Iran's not a great actor. Like, they're bad dudes. You know, they've said that they want to blow up Israel. They said they're going to get this nuclear weapon despite the nuclear deal. So I think right off the bat, we need to isolate Iran. I'd take away their power base. I mean, most of the terrorists and terrorist attacks that when I was over in Iraq as a SEAL were paid for, trained by, provided by, given by, assisted by Iran. So we need to isolate them from the fight, and we can do that with sanctions, but we can also say, look, the next time you contribute to terrorism that harms an American citizen, we will reduce an entire installation to rubble. And then when they do it, which they will, you deliver. And that's the only language that these people speak. So you take Iran completely out of the fight. That's going to give a massive amount of credibility to us within the region to say, wow, America's actually going to act if we cross them. You can try to negotiate. I was on with Dennis Kucinich the other day, and he was like, well, we need to be diplomatic in the region, you know, with Saudi Arabia. Nobody's interested in being diplomatic over there. People just are looking for self-preservation in that region, and there's no diplomatic connections that's going to solve this. You need to eliminate bad guys, and that's what the U.S. military does best.
Yes, that's for sure. And now with Trump in office, I feel like if we do make those threats, we'll actually follow through. Obama, I kind of lost count of how many red lines he drew.
Yeah, and Obama has never delivered on a forceful promise. But I mean, Donald Trump has demonstrated conclusively, look, he dropped that Moab, that 22,000-pound munition. There are much better munitions we have in our arsenal that could have done bunker busting and subterranean explosions and things like that, but he chose to use that one because, A, it's never been used before, and, B, it's the biggest thing we got. So it sent a message that says, keep pushing, guys, because we got more of these.
Yeah. Yeah, well, especially if he suddenly decides to pull the $1 trillion that Obama had wanted to spend from the Paris Accords, suddenly we can buy a lot more of those.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the other thing, too, is you have the new conflict bubbling up is North Korea.
Yes.
I mean, North Korea poses the same danger as Japan did in World War II. So what are we waiting for? Are we going to wait for another Pearl Harbor, or are we going to go deal with this proactively?
Well, yeah, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit more in the next segment there. There is a lot happening there in North Korea. In terms of Syria, though, do you think Trump is kind of going along the road that you had lined out, where he is going to get on the same page with Russia? But what do you see after that? I mean, do we then pull out completely from supporting those rebels?
I mean, I think so. It's not our war, and I understand that it's a terrible travesty, and there's human deaths that are unjustly being endured over there. But you know what? Like, it is just not our problem. Now, when they start threatening the United States with the expansion of ISIS, we tell Assad, be like, this is your country. Deal with this problem, or we will. And we go in there. We don't set sights to reoccupy the country. We set sights to kill bad guys. And that's what we do. We're going to do it from the ground. We're going to do it from the air. But you cannot commit to nation building in a culture that we don't understand, that doesn't want Western democracy, doesn't speak Western democracy, and has only ever had dictators throughout the course of history.
Yeah.
I mean, half this population doesn't even use toilet paper, and you want them to understand complex democracy?
Yeah, exactly right. Well, I agree with you.
Well, I get a little carried away with this.
Well, but I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right, is that this is not our war. We have to give them the freedom to figure it out for themselves, for sure. All right, let's take a break. Coming back, we'll talk about North Korea. Welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson. We're wrapping things up here with Carl Higbee, a special operator with SEAL Team 10, and he's also author of the book Enemies, Foreign and Domestic, A SEAL's Story, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. Just look for the store page, and that's got not only Carl's books, but all of our guests' books up there as well. And so, Carl, let's shift gears here and talk about North Korea. I mean, this is just a horrible situation that's going on over there. You know, with Syria, you've got all of these different factions going on. Here with North Korea, you have one crazy guy who maybe is hearing voices from all these other factions. I'm not sure. But what do you think is going to – if push came to shove, do you think Trump will launch forces and or some other sort of military strike there?
Well, you know, here's the thing with North Korea, and I had mentioned this earlier, is that it is a very different enemy than what we're fighting in the Middle East, in the sense that poses the same or similar threat to a Japan during World War II. I mean, except that they are a nuclear capable country right now.
Yeah.
So you have, I mean, granted, 2/3 of their population lives far below their own poverty line, but the issue is all their funding does go into military. They have a 700,000 person standing army. They have technology. So the issue is, if you're going to send ground troops into a place like this, which I don't recommend at this time at all, you know, subject to change as always, but you cannot do so until you control the airspace. Because when you have a country that has, I mean, we've seen it in Syria, with the ability to take out large number of people with one airstrike. I mean, we do it all the time. It's a very effective tool against ground troops. So if you want to invade North Korea, you got to control the airspace. To do that is going to take enormous resources, and a lot. We're going to have to really debilitate Fat Boy Kim's military standards. So if you want to get what I would recommend, if I was in charge of the Pacific Fleet or making a recommendation to the Pentagon or Trump, I would say, look, you know, we got to have an urgency to shoot down every single test missile. Shoot it down and let the world see you shoot it down. And then when they shoot another one, you blow up the installation that it came from. And you do that over and over and over again until they get the message. That way they know that those missiles cannot leave the ground without American intervention.
Hmm. Well, in terms of North Korea itself, I mean, with Syria, you've got all of these different factions. They're vying for control over their particular areas. It's not like North Korea is being threatened that we're going to take them over. So why is he doing all this saber rattling other than for the fact of trying to rattle his saber?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, here's the thing is, North Korea has been affected by the greatest propaganda machine we have seen in the last, you know, I think ever. I mean, he genuinely has his people convinced that the reason they have ills in their life is because of the Western society and mostly the United States of America. So, you know, Kim Jong-il is going to rattle the saber because he believes, I call him the uber millennial. He has been given everything, never had a consequence, never been told no, and he's been spoiled rotten. So this is the worst case scenario of what happens when you put a millennial in charge. Nobody, I mean, the guy killed his own brother.
Yeah.
So he doesn't know any consequences. So I think he's genuinely crazy enough to believe that he could wage a war with the United States of America and win. And because he's crazy enough to believe it, his propaganda machine spins it, and his own people believe it too.
Well, and again, we come back to the notion of having some kind of working relationship with Russia, because they would certainly be able to wield some influence there. And then, of course, you add China into the mix. I found it actually very fascinating that China turned back some of the coal shipments and oil shipments, and there was several other shipments they turned back. I find that very encouraging that China is starting to say, yeah, we need to get some handles on this crazy guy over here.
Yeah, but I think they're trying to isolate themselves from any perception of aid or assistance or working with because of their relationships with us. I mean, Trump is a very good negotiator. The other thing, too, is, you know, they put 140 or 150,000 troops on the border right there to block anybody from coming into China. Now we need to get them to say, I mean, here's the thing, too, that China and South Korea understand very well that we haven't really wrapped our heads around yet, is that let's say we take out Kim Jong-un. Those people don't know anything outside of a dictatorship, so their economy, their way of life, everything will have to be absorbed. You know, the burden of their society and their woes will have to be absorbed by either China or South Korea or the United States, or someone's going to have to come in there and support something and stand. I mean, like, I don't think Kim Jong-il, he's one of the times that I do recommend that they get rid of a dictator.
Mm.
But it needs to be a multinational approach, because, you know, what are we going to do? Park an aircraft carrier there and give, you know, homeless food to all the people in the gulags? No, we don't have the resources or the patience to do that.
Well, you mentioned there about the dictator. I mean, it's kind of like we're looking at Syria in sort of the reverse. I mean, in Syria, we basically said, okay, let's leave Assad there. It's their mess. They need to clean it up. You can't quite do that with North Korea, because you do have a dictator that has nuclear weapons. It's a very different situation.
Oh, it's a hugely different situation. Well, you have some, I mean, like, here's the thing is, and who do you think is going to be the first person to sell a nuclear warhead? You know, I mean, the country is economically strapped. I find it very likely that they would sell a nuclear warhead to a terrorist organization. I mean, all they need is one.
Yeah.
And additionally, this guy has made open threat. Like, Assad's not saying, I'm going to go nuke the United States of America. Assad's not doing that. He's like, I don't, you know, screw the United States, they're pissing me off and they're meddling in my business. He says that all the time. But he's not actively going out and saying, I'm going to nuke, you know, Seoul, South Korea.
Well, in a lot of ways, Assad is actually saying, look, just leave me alone. And North Korea is not taking that approach.
Right, and they're provoking it even further. So it's like, we have no choice. And, you know, you're never going to get a team in there to do any type of groundwork because of, like I said, because of his Air Force. You have to do something. You know, I, to be honest, and this is a little controversial, the next time Kim Jong-un tests a nuclear weapon, I say we fire another nuclear weapon right into the same crater that he just tested and be like, we got those too, homie.
Yeah, that's maybe just a tad controversial.
Yeah, but hey, you know what? Like, if he's going to do it, might as well do it in the same spot with the same payload just to be like, yep, we got those too.
Yeah.
And let them know that, be like, you do not want to try to fight with us on this.
Yeah.
I mean, well, it's not like we're nuking a city. It would be nuking a nuclear test site.
Yeah, yeah. Well, fascinating discussion for sure. I mean, on the one hand there with Syria, we're dealing with a bully, and with Kim Jong-il, we are definitely dealing with a crazy person. Carl, I want to thank you so much for your time today and your insights.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye. You know, as I listened to today's guest, what really impressed me was the need for action. Any strategy is only as good as the action people actually take. And in such a complicated, multifaceted situation like Syria, it's easy to do nothing. But a businessman like Trump knows that some action, even if it's imperfect, is better than no action, which is what Obama's strategy was in the Middle East. You might not have agreed with Trump's missile strike, but what it revealed is that there are more of these coming if you don't get your act together. A little swat on the butt. Check out the webpage, iSpyRadio.com. We have a bunch of articles up there if you want to explore this topic more. Links to our guest webpages, books, and their Twitter feeds. And I'm on Twitter, too, at iSpyRadio. Give me a follow. I'd love to hear from you. That's all of our time for today. We certainly hope that you're at least a little wiser than when you got here. Actions, not words. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.